this is Christopher Long, and you're listening to The Digital Dialogue, a podcast dedicated to cultivating the excellences of dialogue in a digital age. This is episode 13, and today I'm joined by Sarah Brill, who is an associate professor of philosophy at Fairfield University and graduate from the philosophy department here at Penn State in 2004, where she wrote her dissertation with John Salas entitled Hygieia, Health, and Medicine in Plato's Republic. Since graduating, she has published numerous articles on Plato and ancient Greek tragedy, including Medical Moderation in Plato's Symposium, published in Studies in the History of Ethics in 2006, Violence and Vulnerability in Aeschylus's Suppliants in a 2009 volume edited by William Wayans entitled Logos and Mythos, Philosophical Essays in Greek Literature, and Politics and Exorbitant Platonism, published in Epoche in 2009. Sarah has also served as a longstanding member of the executive committee in the Ancient Philosophy Society, where she has been instrumental in establishing a vibrant community centered around original and creative readings of ancient philosophers. Today, she has agreed to join the Digital Dialogue to discuss her work related to a new book on the political tenor of Plato's psychology entitled Prosthetic Life, Political Psychology in Plato's Phaedo, Republic, and Laws. It's a great pleasure to welcome Sarah Brill to the Digital Dialogue.
Thank you, Chris, and thank you for that kind introduction. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. So I wanted to start with just asking you to maybe talk a little bit about the manuscript and the book that you're working on, and tell us a little bit about sort of what animates it and what stage you are also in the process.
Sure. Thank you. Yeah, I could say a little bit about just the history of the project and then briefly review the general argument and the more specific argument that's at work there. Mm-hmm. I started working on this both out of a kind of fascination with the relationship between the eschatological or afterlife myths that are at work in the Phaedo, the Republic, and the Laws, and their relationship with the broader psychology in those dialogues, and the broader dialogues themselves as a whole. Mm-hmm. And also out of some dissatisfaction with this, what I take to be a kind of general assumption of complementarity between Plato's metaphysics traditionally conceived and his psychology. It seems to me that more often than not, the discussions of soul that Plato has trouble the distinctions between being and becoming, between visible and intelligible, the kinds of distinctions that are often taken to be in full force in his metaphysics. Mm-hmm. And also dissatisfaction with this sort of scholarly convention of separating out his moral psychology from his epistemology. Mm. I understand why people do that, but at the same time, it seems to me that part of what so interested and troubled Plato about psyche, about soul, is that it presents a unity and needs to be thought about as such. Mm-hmm. So while it has implications both in his accounts of justice and injustice and of knowledge, part of what drives his sustained interest in the entity is that it nevertheless comprises a kind of unity.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, how does that on your account, how does the Plato's psychology relate? I know you drew our attention to the eschatological questions. So, mm-hmm. how do those two issues relate?
Yeah, that's a great question. It seems to me that the eschatological myths in these three dialogues do a number of things. Mm-hmm. One, they provide a kind of critique of the arguments, the logoi, that precede them. And we can see that particularly clearly in the myth of the earth in the Phaedo, where that begins with an explicitly critical gesture Socrates makes about a character in a tragedy by Aeschylus named Telephus. But that also really seems to be pointing to a kind of failure of the preceding logoi to provide a sufficiently rich and adequate account of living being. Mm-hmm. So there's, I think, a critical component to these myths that is often, I think, overlooked for their more abundant speculative possibilities. I think also these myths have a kind of cultivation of a vocabulary for talking about viciousness and violence and suffering that is enormously important to Plato's thought, broadly conceived ethical thought. Mm-hmm. So when, for instance, we read that the souls of homicides and parasites and matricides are circling around these lakes and rivers and come into contact with the souls of those they've slain, that they're supposed to be asking them, these souls of the people that they've slain, for forgiveness. Mm-hmm. You know, we wonder, what is that attempting to describe? What kind of rhetoric would be at work for these souls? And I think Plato's wondering that as well, and trying to think through the very difficult effects on the city of violent action. So part of what I think is going on in these myths is this cultivation of a sort of nascent phenomenology of violence. Mm. And then a third point that seems to be at work in these myths is some opening for philosophical reflection of the powerful effect on human action that is had by particular beliefs in the soul. So in the same way that what people think about death affects what they do, so also, I think for Plato, what they think about their souls and whether they think about having souls has some powerful effects on their actions. Yeah. So all three of these dimensions seem to be at work in these myths that connect them to the arguments that are made in the dialogues in which they appear.
Right, so you see the distinction between mythos and logos as one that needs to recognize a certain continuity between the two.
Continuity, and also, you know, I would argue for a much stronger, again, critical function to the myths than I think is usually attributed to them, that they really are attempting to point out inadequacies in the logoi that surround them.
I see. So the issue of, I mean, so, but then you do hold on to the idea of a relatively strict distinction between logos and mythos.
Yeah, but that statement certainly suggests it. But I mean, I think, again, you know, we're talking about words that in some of their most ancient usages meant something almost synonymous, right? Speaking, speech, words. So, and there are certainly other dialogues, like Gorgias, for instance, where Socrates displays a kind of indifference about whether what he's about to say is called a logos or a mythos. Mm-hmm. So it seems as though there are distinctions to be drawn, but they're fluid and porous, and sometimes it suits the character of Socrates to draw those distinctions, and sometimes it suits him to elide them.
Right. But what you're really asking in part about is what are the political dimensions of Platonic myth-making in the context of certain dialogues. So the power, at least that I hear you arguing, the power of certain kinds of myths to get us to turn our attention to certain questions that can animate life really suggests that you have a strong political dimension to the myth that is other than, let's say, what is often ascribed to Plato's political views.
That's right, absolutely. And, you know, the book itself talks quite a bit about myth, but its overarching argument is really about the sort of challenge to thought that animates Plato's discussions of soul very often seems to be its malleability or its very curious plasticity. Mm-hmm. That defies sort of easy assessment of its ontological status. And so when he talks about the soul as immortal or deathless, he does so in a couple of contexts that really illustrate this strange plasticity. And so the more specific argument that I'd like to make is that at sort of very decisive junctures in these dialogues, when Socrates is contending with psychic plasticity or malleability, the dialogue takes a very sharply political turn to focus on the demands that this plasticity places on the city as the arena of human flourishing, or where human flourishing is won or lost. Mm-hmm. So it seems like his, you know, a broad conception of his psychology creates mandates for the city, and locates the polis within the cosmos in very particular ways. So I want to explore what role the city is to have in the lives of its citizens and in the cosmos of which it is a part, granted the kind of entity that Plato frequently describes soul as, namely as this complex, very malleable, plastic entity that has both simplicity and complexity as part of its possibilities for being.
Right. So on that reading, and I know you sent me a little bit of material from one of the chapters on the Phaedo, it does seem that the Phaedo takes on a provocatively important political tenor on the reading that you're trying to offer. That is to say, it's not really in so much about whether a proof for the immortality of the soul, but as Socrates himself, I think, argues toward the beginning, this is a question about a certain way of life, a kind of a way we choose to live.
That's right. That's right.
So could you maybe talk a little bit about the your view of the practice of philosophy in that light?
Sure. Yeah.
Small matter.
Sure. The practice of philosophy is such a great phrase because it calls our attention to, I think, the many instances where Plato seems to conceive of philosophizing as entailing a particular kind of life. Mm-hmm. So some of the things that your other interlocutors have said, like Marina McCoy and Jill Gordon, about the role of inquiry and questioning are things that I think are vital to understanding what Plato is doing with conceiving of what constitutes a philosophical life. But I would also want to add that part of what seems to be going on in both the Phaedo and the Republic is the sense that human beings have, as part of their capacities, the ability to be gripped by ideas. Mm. And this has both, you know, lovely effects and also terrible effects, depending upon the idea and upon passionate investment made in it. And so we could offer a sort of sublimation model of philosophy, that part of what it's there to do is to cultivate a particular passional engagement with ideas. So what we see often in the Phaedo is this account of the philosopher as the ardent pursuer of being. And that because soul has a sort of kinship with being, this makes the philosopher in a sort of unique or privileged or exceptional position with respect to soul. Right. But we should also keep in mind, especially with respect to the Republic, that those beings who have the qualities that might make them philosophic might also make them tyrannical. Right. And it's sort of the role of the city and the model of education that it promotes that will turn those capacities toward this ardent pursuit of being and away from tyranny.
Right. Well, I mean, last week I was talking with Mark Munn, and we had a discussion really around both the positive and the dangerous dimensions of rooting politics in the erotic, which he's arguing, of course, from a cultural and historical perspective. But it does seem that, on your view, and I agree with this, that Plato had a keen sensitivity to the political dimensions of Eros, and that he put Socrates in contexts in which Socrates can both show the politically dangerous dimensions of an erotic orientation, and yet also the powerful political and transformative possibilities, the right kind of relationship to questions of the good, questions of the just, and even with respect to your work on the soul, with respect to the immortality of the soul. So the proper orientation to the question of death,
right,
and whether the soul is immortal or not,
right,
is precisely what seems to animate at least a lot of what Socrates is doing throughout his political life. So that's
right.
That's the part that's the one of the aspects that interests me with respect to my project, because although I'm interested in what Plato might have thought about politics, I'm more interested in what sort of Socrates shows himself to be doing in the dialogues, and
right,
what kind of politics we might draw from that. And so that's why your work on the Phaedo is really interesting from my perspective, because you've been able to suggest that what we should be thinking about is how human situatedness and the human relationship to the gods really constitutes a certain kind of or demands really a certain kind of life. And so thinking through that is really important. So maybe you could talk a little bit about the relationship between piety and philosophy, and how you see that sort of religious context in the Phaedo being transformed in some ways by Socrates into a philosophical perspective.
Oh, goodness. Yeah. I mean, and I would like also to hear a little bit more about your own conception of the relationship between piety and philosophy. It's a very rich question.
Well, if my students post on the blog that I have going for them, when anytime God is mentioned or piety, we get 40, 50 comments on it. So they're really animated by the question.
Sure. Yeah. It's an animating question.
Sure.
I mean, I think, I have lots of thoughts, but I'm not sure how cohesive all of them are. I mean, so much of the language in the Phaedo and also in the Republic, and especially in the Laws, about the relationship between humans and the divine has this very, in my opinion, distressing emphasis on ownership and service. We humans are possessions, you know, katamata of the gods, and they are our owners. And so suicide is problematic insofar as you remove yourself from the service of good owners. So all of those tropes of ownership and service, I think are provocative, and I find them personally difficult. But they're not the only way that Plato depicts discussing the gods. We, you know, also have one of the conceptions of soul's deathlessness as its, you know, ability to become like God or to become like the divine. And so that inscribes a kind of, you know, poetic and transformative dimension to philosophy that I think is quite interesting.
But I wonder what, if we could just pause there for a minute about the possession issue, because you do bring up a point that's really, I think, an important one. And I wonder if we could think about it in terms of the kind of, even in terms of the kind of question of knowledge and the possibility of possessing knowledge. So from my understanding, and maybe you have different passages in mind, but when Plato has Socrates talk about being possessed, and particularly with regard to the Phaedo, being possessions of the gods, it's the gods who possess us, and what that does is inscribe, or let's say impose in certain sense upon us, certain kinds of demands. And maybe there's something important about thinking about the demands that are imposed upon us as human beings in a cosmos. So let's take the religious dimensions of God out of it for a minute and turn the question a little bit towards a more what I would consider kind of naturalistic perspective. And I hear what I'm calling a naturalism in your claims that there's this cosmological dimension, a kinship between the soul and nature. And so I, just to be clear, don't mean by naturalism any kind of materialism and any kind of reductive naturalism, but really tuned into the Greek conception of phusis, of which we humans are a part.
Right.
And so if we think about the question of what does nature demand of us, as being thrown into a certain kind of context with the capacity to understand, but always inadequately. What kinds of, so maybe we could turn the question of possession into a question of responsibility in a certain way.
Again, fascinating complex of issues there. And the question of nature and of phusis is also so rich, and also again can and has been taken up in such problematic ways. So thinking about nature as normative seems certainly pervasive in Platonic thought, But what that ultimately comes out to mean, I think, is far more mysterious, interesting, and complicated. So for instance, in a text like The Laws, at a certain point, the Athenian stranger will say that soul has this very excessive relationship to phusis, and there he uses a word that, you know, could be translated as superlative, but also as exceeding, as somehow beyond phusis. And so, you know, we might also want to think about the way the relationship between phusis and techne, or that fraught relationship between phusis and nomos, about which Plato and so many other thinkers in the ancient Greek world had to comment. Right. But to get back to your question about responsibility, it seems as though the whole notion of living being seems to include for Plato this possibility, at least for humans, of conceiving of your life as a whole. Right. And part of what it seems as though these afterlife myths are doing is trying to present human action in a context that is broad enough to be able to really consider the effects of those actions on the polis. Yeah. So while individual humans are driven by pleonexia, they're driven by this kind of acquisitive, ceaseless striving to acquire, there needs to be some mechanism to view those actions within a larger context. Mm-hmm. And so it seems like the work of a lot of these afterlife myths is to provide a kind of what I would describe as a prosthetic vision of the effect of human action, and especially the effect of pleonexia, of this boundless, limitless acquisitiveness on the city.
But I mean, in that regard, so there's more than there's more to it also on my view to mm-hmm. what you're saying, because mm-hmm. The issue is not just the impact on the city in a traditionally political sense, that is to say, mm-hmm. The organization of the assembly and the decisions that are made through the deliberations that are undertaken there. But it seems to me that what Socrates is recognizing in the dialogues is that the profound political implications of turning souls toward that vision of the whole. Of the mm-hmm. whole of their lives, and therefore yeah. of, and in fact, when he turns people toward the question of the good and the just and the yeah. beautiful, yeah. even when he turns our attention to the immortality of the soul in the Phaedo,
right.
he's really getting us to think about the whole of our lives, and yeah. also in the context of, let's say, a certain kind of vision of yeah. the whole of things.
Yeah, I think that's so... very well put, and also calls our attention to the impediments to viewing our lives as a whole. What is it that sort of stands in the way of such a vision? Because, you know, it does seem to me that quite a bit of the sort of Platonic pathologies that Plato outlines, you know, the what he calls in The Laws this sort of excessive self-love, or, you know, this blindness toward the good. We strive toward it but don't know what it is. Mm-hmm. These sort of dimensions of human life require others and a specific kind or specific kinds of relationships with others to grant a vision that a single individual would not normally have.
Right.
And so part of the job of the city, or of a good city, it seems as though Plato is suggesting, is to do that, to have a certain modes of discourse mm-hmm. that offer visions of the whole.
Right. So now, in that yeah. context, the stories we tell about ourselves, the narrative that we come up with about why we are who we are as a mm-hmm. as a community, mm-hmm. all of that is bound up with this attempt to get some articulation of the whole.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And what I think is very philosophically compelling and again also disturbing about this need for some account of the whole that is produced collectively is that it also has these very profound conservative possibilities, mm-hmm. right? The ideologies that we tell about ourselves or the stories that we tell about our background, or
doesn't that danger emerge precisely mm-hmm. when the mm-hmm. excessive elusive dimension of mm-hmm. Our relationship to the whole is denied? That is to say, if mm-hmm. rather than having this relationship where we recognize, even as we attempt to articulate what the whole might be, but right. when we recognize its elusiveness, our finitude.
Great.
That's when we can go a long way in combating a certain kind of conservative ideology yeah. that says, no, we have possession of that whole.
Right.
And therefore, you know, when you say X, Y, or Z, you're wrong because you don't have it the way we do.
That's right. I again, very well put. And part of what I think is so important about emphasizing the critical function of some of these myths mm-hmm. is precisely that what Plato is trying to do is mobilize a certain language, a certain vocabulary, but in such a manner as to point up its incompleteness mm-hmm. and its capacity for criticizing itself, a mm-hmm. kind of dialectical mythology. Mm-hmm. So part of what you can notice in, again, for instance, the Phaedo myth is that it locates Socrates and his interlocutors in a profoundly contingent and incomplete place. Their vision of where they are is flawed. Mm. And so it's not simply a vision of the whole. It's also a vision of the incompleteness of any particular account of the whole.
Right. And also, I think it's a powerful articulation, the Phaedo is, mm-hmm. of the possibilities for human community mm-hmm. that emerge
right.
out of that kind of orientation. I mean, Socrates really demonstrates the degree to which he's caring of and careful with his interlocutors in that dialogue, and I think that the issue that arises there as a kind of critical point of mythology and misanthropy
yeah.
is really
yeah.
become central on this
yeah.
point.
Yeah, and that discussion, like, thank you for reminding us of that, because it is also so rich and there's so much there to talk about. And if I remember it correctly, I think Socrates even makes the claim that mythology is worse than misanthropy.
Right.
And I think that's very interesting. To me, that suggests that a certain comportment toward logos is actually necessary for philanthropy.
Mm-hmm.
That comporting ourselves towards others requires comporting ourselves towards logos in a particular way.
Right, and I mean that really does bring me back to this whole question of how you're conceiving the soul, mm-hmm. psyche, in relationship to the larger cosmological
yeah.
Structure of things. Let's just say,
yeah.
Because
yeah.
it really is, at least on my view, a question of a proper way of being a being that has logos and having, not in the sense of possessing, but to be human is to have logos in a certain kind of way, which doesn't mean that other animals have no logos at all. If we have a broad enough understanding of what logos is for the Greeks, that doesn't just mean rational articulation, but means the certain way in which nature itself expresses itself.
Right. Yeah, I mean, part of why I am so interested in psyche and am writing a book on psyche and not on phusis or mm-hmm. cosmos or logos
right.
is that some of the accounts of soul, especially in the Laws, I have to say, look at both phusis and techne and logos itself as manifestations of psyche. So there's something about each of these entities and nomos as well, law as well, that provides a sort of manifestation of psychic action or something along those lines. So it's a particularly dense site for investigating the relationship between logos, between techne, between phusis, and between law. Mm-hmm. And you know, the phrase immortality of soul, I almost cringe every time I use it because it's so fraught. But you know, immortality itself for Plato is this very vexed issue. So we shouldn't pretend like we know what it means for him, that to attribute deathlessness for the soul sometimes means that he's saying that soul is that by means of which we approximate the divine or nous or mind or something along those lines. But he also at times talks about it as that entity that is unique insofar as it endures its own corruption. Right. So the implication of soul and vicious and violent action is interestingly also an attestation to its deathlessness.
Right. I mean, you know, in the Symposium, Socrates has Diotima talk about the you know, generation and the kind of being human being together as animated by an attempt to have a certain kind of earthly immortality. So yeah. It's definitely we definitely have to think in a much more a pluralistic way about what immortality might mean for someone like Plato in that context. I mean, one might say, one might imagine that he's quite happy that we're having podcasts about him and about Socrates, and recognizing that that is a way in which Socrates and his thinking are immortal to a certain degree, right? They've lived beyond their lives.
Right. Well, and it seems also so this sort of economy of honor that gets, you know, transformed into this very interesting reflection on the way in which vicious actions have a sort of endurance that attests to this sort of psychic quality of being able to endure its own corruption, right? In Republic 10, Socrates gives this very odd discussion of immortality, that soul is deathless because nothing can kill it. Mm-hmm. Its modes of corruption, injustice, don't result in its being rendered inefficacious in the world.
Right.
And so the city and its laws is precisely what steps in to compensate for this limitlessness that expresses itself in the uncanny endurance of violent deeds.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit more about that, because you keep bringing us back to violence and to this issue, and I feel like I haven't addressed it, or at least responded in a way that does justice to your concern there. Could you talk a little bit more about what's animating you? I understand, I think, the idea of the way myths allow Plato to articulate the real damaging dimensions of violence.
Mm-hmm.
But talk a little bit more about your concern with violence in this, with regard to this project, or with regard to what we've been talking about.
Oh, sure. I mean, on the one hand, it seems like one very animating feature of Plato's thought is precisely this sort of traumatizing or endurance of vicious action. So mm-hmm. It seems like the thing that really concerns Glaucon and Adamantus.
Right.
It comes up again in the Laws with a character who is very concerned about lack of punishment for unjust deeds, or the lack of expiation for unjust deeds. So there seems to be something about this notion of the endurance of unjust action that really speaks to Plato. And when we think about his work in the context of classical tragedy, that makes a lot of sense, because so many of the tragedies are about the enduring effects of unjust action. You know, the tragedy of the House of Atreus, right? Mm-hmm. Where you have this sort of this deed that perpetually works itself through to horrific effect the lives of a family. So this was not, you know, an unusual thing to be investigating, but it does really seem to be have a persistent significant interest for Plato through a number of dialogues. Mm-hmm. What I find interesting from a more contemporary perspective about it is that, you know, we often have the tendency to conceive of violent action as fundamentally antisocial. And there's something very right about that, but I also think that it can mislead us into thinking that violence occurs in the absence of a certain kind of very very disturbing and damaging connection. I mean, the relationship between violence and their the deed's victim, mm-hmm. is profound and needs an account, and I'm not sure that there is one forthcoming. So when I think of films like when I talk about this with my students, you know, I often show films like In the Bedroom, right, where you see this sort of horrific connection between someone who has lost someone and the person who is ostensibly responsible for that loss. Mm-hmm. And so it seems like any critique of violence needs a rich account of that disturbing connection.
Yeah, well, this is actually really interesting from the perspective of, you know, the political implications of trauma and how we right. how we handle trauma and how we right. use we always and often use narrative right. To make sense of the trauma, deal with it, put it into a larger context, and thereby also, in a certain sense, justify our community to some degree. So I can see a kind of argument in which you want to suggest, drawing on the Greek tragedy model, that really these stories and our way of making meaning out of them have a profoundly mm-hmm. communal dimension to them.
That's right.
They animate community all the time.
That's right. I mean, and part of what I think is going on with Plato's use, especially in the Phaedo, of the language of pollution mm-hmm. and impurity, is that he is appealing to a vocabulary that is committed to describing the context that is inaugurated by certain actions, and homicide is, I think, the one that is, you know, most polluting and most indicative of this context in which an entire family and an entire community are implicated. Right. So the expiation for certain kinds of violent deeds requires a collective mobilization that acknowledges the forms of contact that have been put into work by the violent deed.
Right. Well, I mean, I think in this regard now, to draw our conversation into relationship to one that Shannon Sullivan and I had mm-hmm. earlier about Noel McAfee's book on democracy and the political unconscious, mm-hmm. I think that we'll post a link to that on, that was episode 8, I think, mm-hmm. Where we really talked about what happens when the certain kinds of traumas occur, and then how they get dealt with in terms of public discourse, and how we come to terms with them, and how if we don't come to terms with them, they'll come to terms with us in certain
ways. Right.
So,
right.
Well, with that, maybe we can end our discussion today. But Sarah, it's been great. I'm going to look forward to having you on again in the context of maybe doing some stuff with the Ancient Philosophy Society, and also as you move toward the publication of your book, we'll definitely have a chance to talk to you again. So thank you so much for coming
on
the Digital Dialogue.
Oh, Chris, thank you. This is such a rich conversation. I really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
The Digital Dialogue is produced under a Creative Commons, non-commercial, share-alike license. To download or subscribe to the Digital Dialogue, visit iTunes U on the Apple iTunes Store and search on Digital Dialogue. You'll find it under the Pennsylvania State University area of the iTunes Store. You may also visit my website, The Long Road, at www.personal.psu.edu/cpl2. This has been The Digital Dialogue.